providing the communities of Waldo, Knox, and Hancock counties with news, information, ideas, events, goods, and services on Newsstands Thursdays and on the web at waldo.villagesoup.com.
Hi, Darwin Davidson here. After quite a few weeks off from hosting Bronzewound, the Bluegrass program, I am ready to get back into the Bluegrass hot seat. This week's Bronzewound will be special indeed, with an on-air call-in from Bill Owens of Billy's Belly Bluegrass Music Festival and Competition. He will be telling us all about this most interesting event, which will take place on August 19th and 20th in Anson, Maine. And I will have 4 admission tickets for the Billy's Belly event to give away. So please join me Thursday, June 22nd, from 8 to 10 p.m. for this interview, the ticket giveaways, and of course, lots of great bluegrass music as always. And it'll all be right here on Community Radio, WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online at WERU.org. See you Thursday.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Maine Seacoast Mission, empowering youth, promoting health, and supporting community on Maine's islands and on the coast, lighting the way by land and sea for over 110 years. Seacoastmission.org.
It is a few seconds after the hour, 10 o'clock, and it's time for Pet Sounds 2.0.
Good morning. This is Pet Sounds 2.0. It's Dr. John Hunt, your host. We are live today. We're going to cover a lot of subjects today. So I want my listeners to feel free to come in on the phone at 469-0500 to contribute or add to our conversation. As you know, this is the monthly every Thursday, every fourth Thursday at 10 a.m. And we talk about a lot of different areas, from salmon, the fish hatchery salmon last month, to legal things, which we're going to talk about today. So we have a lot of different topics. So today I'm having a return guest, Christina Perkins, a lawyer in Ellsworth, and an old friend and a fellow animal lover, and her best buddy, Rye. So I have a little treat here for Rye, see if he'll eat it. I think Rye is not interested. So maybe you'll eat it later. So, Christina, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us back.
Wow, we didn't cover all the things we wanted to, but since then, other new things have come our way. So let's get into first some legislation that we wanted to alert our listeners about.
Yes, and that has to do with the Help Fix Me program, which provides assistance for low-income folks to spay and neuter their cat or dog. And as you know from your experience many years, it's really important.
Yes, it has been a staple in my private practice when I was practicing for years and years. Very, very popular. A lot of people who want pets and deserve pets, but that couldn't quite find the funds for spaying and neutering, which is so important, reached out to this, or the state reached out to them, and actually the funds dried up, were used up very quickly. So we actually need more.
And that's exactly, I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly what this legislation is about. It's LD 1601, and it was introduced to cut the funding, interestingly enough, for the program, and then it got amended and now seeks to increase it.
Good.
And our governor intends to, from what I've heard, veto it tomorrow. So it's really critically important that all animal lovers and people in support of spay and neuter programs call their local legislators and ask to help override or defeat the veto of the governor that he intends to issue tomorrow.
So to make it clear, because I'm not quite clear on that, is he vetoing the increase, or is he vetoing the entire Help Fix Me program?
The increase, okay, the bill as amended.
Okay, so it won't disappear.
Well, it won't pass if his veto is successful.
So that will Help Fix Me then disappear?
I believe the funding will stay the same to the level as it is, because it was introduced to eliminate it. And it's really about the pet food charge. It's
The tax on the pet foods.
The surcharge on the the brands, the manufacturers. Not home pet food, but manufacturers. They have a registration surcharge. And that is what funds the program in large part. In addition to the tax write-off, the check-off on your income tax box, you can donate to the Help Fix Me program, and the license plate, of course. And so the pet food industry has been successful in tried to be successful in challenging this funding mechanism for Help Fix Me over the years. And so this time around, what the bill is doing as amended is it is increasing the funds for Help Fix Me rather than eliminating it. So it's really important that we call and
How are the funds going to be increased? What way are they?
They're going to be increased. Let me just pull up the bill here. Bear with me because I'm not good with numbers.
While you're looking for numbers, I just want to say call 469-0500 if you want to chime in on this topic and anytime until 11 o'clock. Pet Sounds 2.0, Dr. John Hunt, your host, and lawyer Christina Perkins, my guest. Is that enough time to get
that
your numbers?
That is. I have it. So what it would mean is that any registration fees in excess of $157,000 total would go into the Help Fix Me program. So if the registration fees are more than $157,000, those additional funds would go directly to Help Fix Me.
Is this registration for
pet food?
Pet food. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first $157,000 is not being
the first $100,000 goes into the Help Fix Me fund.
Oh, okay.
It's by
okay.
statute. That's what happened when it was created.
Right.
That's why the pet food surcharge is so critical in funding Help Fix Me. The first $100,000 goes into Help Fix Me. From $100,000 to $157,000 goes into the general animal welfare and the animal welfare fund, not the general fund, the animal welfare fund. And then anything above $157,000 under this amended bill would also go to Help Fix Me.
Okay.
So it has its first $100,000, and then if anything is over $157,000, that would go.
I don't know if you had this on your fingertips. Do you have information on how much money is generated by the license plates and percentage-wise?
I don't, but okay. I believe that it's less than
what's needed.
Than the registration. It's always less than needed because the program always runs out of money.
Yeah, and I'll talk to about that in a minute. We do have a caller already. Sarah from Stonington. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Oh, good. It's funny. I'm listening on like in the room, and I'm also listening online.
Oh, stereo.
I know. Is there a phone number to call to protest? That's my question.
Good question.
Yes, good question. You should call your local legislator, whoever they are, and I don't know who it is for Stonington, but that's the person you would call. And I suppose you can also call the governor's office and tell him not to veto it.
Sure.
Okay.
I don't know if he'll listen. But.
Yeah, I don't know who our local legislator. Okay, I'll find out.
Yeah,
okay.
If you go to maine.gov, and there should be a link that's easy to find that will help you find your local representatives and senators for Maine.
Campbell is Bucksport. I don't know. Yeah, you
yeah, I don't
look,
know
Sarah.
Stonington either. But if you go to maine.gov, you'll be able to quickly plug it in. Even you could even Google it, and the search engine will come up for the state that helps you.
Great. All right. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, exercise your rights as a citizen. That's excellent, Sarah. Thank you. And in my experience, before I retired, for years I used the Fix Me, and it was it had been used up by March. It started up every January with X amount of money, and by March it was gone.
The funds go very quickly.
And that's that's not right. We should have funds available for longer. And it's very important because our pet population is a real problem for the animals and their welfare with animals that don't have any homes. Animals get euthanized because it's overpopulation. They get released in the wild and become strays. But also, it's a real drag on the townships to control that.
Absolutely.
And the health and the health of our animals that we take care of. So it's really a service that benefits everybody, including people who do not own pets. People who don't own pets need to have a community that's safe and not overrun.
Exactly. To add to that, you know, years ago when the program was started, you know, we had a huge cat overpopulation problem. We still do. It's still pretty big.
Yes.
But some of the shelters are reporting that their cat numbers and their kitten numbers, even during kitten season, are down. And when this program was implemented, our projection back then was, you know, 5 to 10 years, we should see a decrease in especially cat numbers.
Right.
And we have. And we've been really successful in the state to do that. And we really need to keep it going so that we don't have huge cat overpopulations again.
And it does take about 5 years for a population of any kind of animal species to show a change. Even the wildlife species, we see a 7-year cycle with the classic is the fox and the rabbit. Rabbits go up every 7 years, the fox population follows, and then they go down, so it's always cyclic. So it takes 5 to 7 years to show up. And it's just not for people that can't afford it. It's for anyone, I believe. Or is there a...
The Help Fix Me program is for low income. Yes.
So you have to demonstrate low income. There are other programs, though, that spay for a cheaper spay and neutering.
Yes.
That are not... Yes. You don't have to prove your income.
They have various requirements. Yeah, whatever the programs are. I mean, there's the community spay neuter clinic, which has been enormously successful.
Right.
And Dr. Elizabeth Stone started that, and it's been, and she travels all over the place with her mobile unit. So there are other options. So if anybody doesn't fall, you know, in the program guidelines for Help Fix Me, they can always call their local shelter or their veterinarian for additional resources.
Years ago, I don't know if they do this anymore as a national thing. I think it was sponsored by Doris Day.
I believe that's still there. Yes.
Still there?
I believe it's still there.
One week in a year, I participated in that. What the veterinarians would do was spay and neuter at a discount. And I must add, though, and I don't practice medicine anymore, so I'm not trying to make any money out of this, but the veterinarians in general, the spay and neuter prices are low. Even though they seem high, for what you what your animal goes through and the kind of service, it should be a lot higher. So veterinarians have kept it as low as they can, but it's still a lot, and we still need people. We still need help for people who really want their pets, and it's a one-time deal. Once they're spayed.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is nice.
Right.
So call your local legislature. Call LePage's office,
because
he's going to do something tomorrow.
And it's LD-1601.
LD-1601. Well, I need a lawyer to come and tell me all this stuff, because that wasn't in the paper. There's nothing in the paper that I saw in today's paper about that.
Yeah, the pet food industry, you know, it has strong lobbyists.
They do, and even in Maine. So, and the tax probably reflects a little bit in the price of your food, but I read someplace it's just pennies.
Yes.
Just pennies on
for
the bag.
The individual
when you
purchaser,
buy your 20-pound bag of X dog food and it costs you $28.50, it's probably the 50 cents
that.
So it is very small, and I think most of the pet-owning public would be overwhelmingly in support of spay and neuter.
And yes, and they have been, and that's why it's survived all these challenges, you know. And this really is an unexpected opportunity for increase in funding that just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that if we can get support from people to call in and just really say this is really important to us, that would be really helpful.
Very good, very good. And Rye has no opinion.
She does. She supports LD-1601.
Yep, she just gave me the nod. Yes,
she does.
She pours, and she did eat my treat. Good. Along the lines of spay, neuter, and population control, the Bangor Humane Society is hosting what they call a kitten and puppy shower, which I think is really cute, and it's scheduled for Saturday, June 17th. And you can go to the Humane Society. Oh, it was. Jeez. Oh, it was June 17th. Okay. This was in today's paper, so I don't know what... Okay, so I stand corrected. It doesn't matter, because the idea of this whole thing is to, if you missed it, you can still contribute gifts to cats, for cats and dogs. Kitten milk replacement, kitty litter, baby wipes, furry mice, kitten food. that sort of thing, to handle the huge influx of kittens that come into Bangor Humane Society. And this Humane Society can't handle all the numbers of kittens, so they depend on foster parents. And foster parents, what they do is they the Humane Society gives these kittens to a foster parent family around 3 or 4 weeks and keeps them to between 8 and 12 weeks. And this allows the kittens to be brought up in a very healthy home. And what they want to do is they're trying to promote people to become foster parents. And I've had experience with foster parents. Ben, my dog Ben, was a dog that was fostered out. He was abused. All my regular listeners know about that. And these people who had other dogs brought Ben into the household. And it was a wonderful environment for Ben. It was just someplace instead of a cage, which was nice. So that was a positive for me. And I know a lady, a client of mine that fosters kittens, and it's wonderful. The kittens get socialization, which is huge, constant contact instead of once a day. What's your experience with foster?
Well, Rye is a foster alum. She came north through a series of foster homes. So, yeah, it's critically important. It provides the socialization and kind of, assesses the pet, maybe the personality to the extent that you can tell with a young animal, and then gives the, the potential adopter some more information. But it's also critical for the shelters because of the numbers, the overwhelming numbers, especially during kitten season. So they may run out of space. And in Maine, we're fortunate that we generally don't euthanize for lack of space anymore. So by providing extra space, so to speak, for kittens that have no space at the shelter or limited space, it really helps out the shelters enormously. And even though the Bangor Humane Society event was last week, I believe most of the shelters, if not all of the shelters in Maine, have their own kitten and puppy showers periodically.
Oh, good.
And have programs. I mean, you can call your local shelter, and I'm sure they'd be more than happy to take any kind of assistance, whether that be fosters, whether that be donations, supplies, money, whatever it might be. I'm sure they're happy to take it.
And it's the foster program is so important psychologically. There's a imprinting time that dogs and cats have between 7 and 12 weeks. That's the time where they can imprint on species other than themselves. So they imprint on people. And if they're in the Humane Society kennel, yes, they do a great job, but they can't possibly give the kind of constant contact that a foster home can. So now you have, not only we're relieving crowding, but we're also socializing these pets so that when someone does adopt them at 12 weeks, whether it's a dog or a cat, they have had exposure to humans, they're imprinted on the humans, and they become well-adjusted pets, and the return rate is going to be a lot lower.
Exactly. And they're used to living in a home. They right. have all the typical experiences that go with home life. They're used to the TV and, that kind of thing. Yeah,
being on the wrong side of the door, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So. And frankly, they're fun. And I think it's really rewarding for the foster home as well because, not everybody's able to adopt today or next week. And so that way you can provide help to the community, to the shelter, and to the animals. And I think it's just really rewarding.
Any foster parents out there? Call in 469-0500 to give us any of your stories about fostering pets. We'd love to hear it. So that just helps our overpopulation because another thing that's going on is the influx of dogs from Mississippi, I think, recently.
Yes.
How many? A thousand? Something like that?
Yeah, there's a lot coming
Coming up into Maine. And there's some good and bad aspects to that. The good is that they're saving animals. The bad is that we're kind of putting a lot of pressure on our pet population here.
Yeah, I don't want to say we have a shortage of dogs in the state, but I've heard from a number of people who have said, I'm trying to adopt a dog and I just can't find one. And that might be a good match. And I follow these adoption events from the Southern Dogs regularly, and the puppies are adopted out, within almost minutes sometimes. So they go, Coastal Humane had a big event I think it was last month, and, you know, boom, the puppies are gone. So there seems to be available homes in Maine. So I think it's a good thing to keep bringing them up as long as, you know, they follow the rules for importation and all the safety.
Health right. issues, huge, right. because the South has a lot of diseases that we don't always see up here, like heartworm and some of the ticks, that sort of thing. That's very important to try to minimize that leapfrogging up into Maine.
Exactly, yes.
Now, I don't know how much you know about it, but are the criteria to adopt a puppy in those circumstances a little less stringent than some of the Humane Society or...
Do you mean the adoption policy or the import?
The adoption policy.
I would hope not. Because I think that, you know, I think the dogs are, you know, entitled to a good home just like Maine dogs. So I would hope not. I'm not aware that there are any less stringent guidelines. And, you know, adoption policies vary from shelter to shelter.
And I know the ARC, the director of the ARC came and we talked about their criteria and the application. And there's a lot of information about where the animal's going. And some people get a little upset about that. But then the ARC has a reason for doing this so that we have our pets adopted into a safe environment.
Right. I mean, we don't want to put...
Sometimes that takes...
Yeah. And, time. You know, and when the ARC, and I should disclose that Ryan and I are on the board of the ARC because she is an ARC alum. You know, when we ask for information in the adoption application and require an adoption contract, it's really to protect the animal because, you know, we don't know the potential adopter. We're not saying you're a terrible person. We're just saying we don't know you. And, you know, we have a responsibility to this animal to make sure the animal is taken care of. And please provide us with information so that we can feel comfortable you're the right person. You're a responsible person, you know. So it's really, if they get offended, I understand that. But it's really not about them as the individual because, again, we don't know them.
And it's kind of, it puts yourself, if you have children that you can send off to a summer camp, you're going to read up on this summer camp, maybe talk to them as to what's the environment like. Is my child going to be cared for? Not necessarily specifics, you know, they're going to do archery and swimming and that sort of thing, but are they going to be cared for in a safe way? That's the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it may seem intrusive, but if you look at it on the dog side or the cat side, it's protecting them.
Exactly.
Protecting.
There is a reason for it.
And fitting a personality like Rye. Rye would not go to any home.
No.
And either did Ben. Ben was super shy, like Rye. And a house full of kids just would not have fit Ben. So it was important to, you know, to make sure you make the right fit.
Right. And the information on the application, you know, who do you live with? Where do you live? Do you rent? How many kids? How many people come in?
Right.
All of that is helpful for the adoption counselor to say, good match, maybe not such a good match. Absolutely.
So be patient if you're trying to adopt a dog or cat. And they are still coming up from the South.
Yes. The ARC is getting several Southern dogs soon, I think.
Good.
So, yes, follow us on Facebook and any of the other shelters.
That's right.
There's lots of dogs coming up.
Equal opportunity advertisement here.
Yes.
Well, getting along again, going along the same course of overpopulation and adopting and foster parents, we have a potential serious problem with pets where people collect pets and they're called hoarders. Hoarding is a defined legal and psychological condition that people have, and they hoard different things, and there are people that hoard animals. And Christine, I think you have some insight into that.
I do. It's very sad. And I think my frustration with the hoarding issue sometimes comes from the lack of help for the hoarder. You know, yes, they should be prosecuted and all of that under the animal cruelty statutes, absolutely, no question. But I think that the piece, the mental illness piece, the psychological piece is often missed, that, you know, they certainly should not have the ability to have animals again, however enforceable that requirement might be. But, you know, you don't recover, as far as I've know, and I've heard and been told by professionals, you don't recover from being a hoarder. Once you're a hoarder, you're always a hoarder. So I think that what we're missing is sort of that realization. And, you know, and very often hoarders start out, you know, there's the hoarders that maybe have a psychological condition of some sort that makes them hoarders. But there's also sort of the accidental hoarder sometimes, I think, because what happens, I mean, we all know the little cat lady down the road, right?
Right.
And so somebody says, well, you know, I didn't spay or neuter my cats and dogs, and now I have a litter, I don't want it. Well, you know what? You know, this lady down the road, she takes them in. And so then community members will bring animals to that person, and then boom, we have a hoarding situation.
Was that hoarding?
I think it is, you know, because then you have maybe an elderly person who might be suffering from some, you know, sort of dementia or something like that, unable to take care of animals. And then, you know, unneutered animals come in and they start, and then, boom, you have a hoarding situation.
So I know that some hoarders have been diagnosed with an obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
And that's a defined
different kind. I think it's both hoarding, because, you know, the person, if you bring me, you know, 100 dogs and I say, you know what, John, I can't take care of that.
Right.
Right. Then I'm not a hoarder and I make other arrangements. But if I maybe I'm a closet hoarder or something, you know, and I say, OK, thanks, John, I'll see what I can do. And then I don't do anything about it. I know it's too much, but I still do it. I think that's hoarding. Because I'm lacking the ability to realize I cannot care for all of those.
Right, that's the hoarding part, so they don't understand the consequences.
Right.
But they must have some kind of positive reinforcement.
Right.
It isn't the animals.
No.
Usually.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I heard a very sad story once where there was a hoarding situation, and law enforcement went in, and there was a hoarder, and she was petting the dead cat and talking to the dead cats.
Oh.
So she was unable to, I guess, realize that they were gone, that they had suffered, died, and, you know, she had basically killed them by neglect. And she was still petting them and talking to them and saying, well, she's fine. Here she is, my cat, you know. So it's very sad.
So the difficulty, the one hoarding case that I am familiar with, it took years for the law enforcement to do something about it. They kept threatening. They kept drawing the line in the sand. And it was literally years. And they did they forced her to remove some of the animals, but not all of them. And then they got more. Like you said, they never get cured.
Yes.
So the laws aren't protecting the animals as much to the way I see it, or do you see it differently? How do you see it as a lawyer?
How do I say this diplomatically? I think the laws are pretty good. We Animal Legal Defense Fund reviews Maine's animal protection laws and the laws in other states, and we always rank in the top five. So I think our laws are pretty good.
In terms of fairness?
In terms of protection, in terms of fairness, in terms of, you know, they're not perfect, and we certainly can improve them, absolutely. But we rank right up there with, you know, with California and the other states. So we have pretty good laws. What we're lacking sometimes is enforcement. It's either funding, you know, for the animal welfare program, which is mostly funded by dog licenses, doesn't get any money from the general fund. So so that's a problem. And also, you know, animal cases are not always priorities for the prosecutors. You know, we have addiction issues. We have all sorts of, you know, stuff that's going on. And so animals sometimes take the back seat. Now, you know, our local district attorney's office is very proactive, but, you know, they all have limited resources. So it's so if it takes years to, you know, end a hoarding situation, it's probably not as much the law as it is the enforcement and the implementation of the law and the funding and the resources available.
Well, who's responsible for enforcing? The local police, the state, the county, or the animal control people?
All of them.
So that's maybe one of the problems. Typically, who's in control? Who's in charge?
Right. Well, but typically, you know, if you have a dog or cat problem, and no, you know, non-wildlife, you would typically call your local animal control officer. Now,
that's a town thing.
Yes. So they typically have, you know, they sometimes have more than one town. You know, especially if you're up in the county or something, they have white territory.
Down here too, they have two or three
our
towns.
Local. Yeah, I mean, we have a great one, yes. Thankfully, and he does a wonderful job. But he also, you know, he has a full time job, I believe, and he also has other towns. So you know, so they do what they can. And then you can also call the Animal Welfare Program in Augusta under the Department of Agriculture. They typically will, if it's a dog or cat issue, tell you, call your local ACO animal control officer and get it addressed. And then if there's, you know, they train local animal control officers, but they don't oversee them. So it's state versus local. So in the particular, you know, if you, I don't know if you remember the Buxton hoarding case back in, I think it was 2004. It had gone on for years. It was, I think in the end, over 300 dogs.
Wow.
And the state ultimately jumped in and said, you know, we're taking over because it just was too huge for any municipality to handle the costs and the number of dogs. And, you know, it was just too huge. So the state jumped in. But generally, the animal welfare programs, humane agents, will work with local animal control officers. And sometimes
and the local
they,
police.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so
yes.
It stays local until it gets out of
right.
control.
If it involves a larger number of animals, I think typically the state gets called in quicker. Or if it involves livestock or horses, sometimes the state gets called in quicker.
I'll ask you about that in a second. But we do have a caller. Yo, how are you this morning, Yo?
Fine, thank you. Good morning. This is Joe in Tremont.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm confused. You say there are too many pets in Maine, but you are importing dogs from the South. You want to find homes for strays, but you insist upon good homes only. You criticize hoarders, but when does boarding become hoarding? Then you talk about enforcement and prosecution. Can't people be entrusted with pets? Or should animal care be the exclusive province of professionals? Thank you for putting on this program, and thank you to everyone for supporting Community Radio.
Thank you, y'all. You presented some very good paradoxes.
Sure,
and,
absolutely.
You can address it, and I can too.
Yes. So with respect to adoptions and import of pets for adoption from other states. Maine does still have a cat problem. It's reduced, but we still do have more cats than we have homes. And so the Help Fix Me program and the plea for funding and spay and neuter is also, yeah, it's intended to help reduce population, cat populations even further, and to prevent explosions so we don't end up where we were maybe 10 years ago. So it's prevention as part of it. The situation as to dogs is a little different. As I said, we've done a wonderful job controlling over a dog overpopulation over the years. I mean, I don't know, John, if you remember the old days when they did euthanize for space. So we've done a wonderful job there. So it really is a different world for cats and dogs when it comes to importation. I'm not aware that anybody is importing cats. And so for dogs, you know, there really are not that many dogs at shelters anymore.
Not like it used to be.
Not like it used to be. And we don't want to get there again, certainly.
Right.
But at the moment, it's different for dogs than it is for cats.
And just to remind everybody that we're not really talking about 95% of the other pets that are in homes, well taken care of, very responsible people, whether they are richer or poor.
Right, absolutely.
So we're talking a small population. It just gets a lot of press because of the consequences, how they influence our society. But we do. But those are very good paradoxes that you presented. But I think, like Christina said, it's a very different world now, and we are in a good. Good path, but it's constant.
Right, we have to be vigilant.
We have to be vigilant.
Yes, yes.
We have another caller, Catherine.
Hi, John.
Hi, Catherine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I don't know if this is applicable, but I would like to talk about puppy mills. Because I remember years ago, before the internet was so popular, I would get Uncle Henry's, and I would look in the beginning, and it was just filled with page after page of dogs being sold. So I would like to know, because I haven't been updating myself on educating with the if there are any laws against puppy mills or if they've been tried to be passed or what have you, but it just breaks my heart. You know, I know that people need to earn money, and this is the way that they do it, but gosh, how many more do we need? And I think also the Amish pretty much are invested in puppy mills. So I was just wondering, is there anything that we can do about this practice? So I'll just listen.
Okay, before Christina answers.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Catherine. That's a different tract than the dogs coming from Mississippi. These are homeless dogs. The puppy mills are for profit business. So go ahead, Christina.
Yeah, puppy mills. I think the one thing that we all can do, and it's hard to do, I mean, I've struggled with that decision myself, is don't buy from puppy mills if you know the source. Don't buy from a pet store. Buy from your local breeder that you can go meet or adopt, of course, that's my preference. Adopt from your local animal shelter. There are some laws in Maine, and there are some federal, you know, with interstate commerce and all of that, that tries to address the puppy mill situation. But I think the laws are not the answer, unfortunately. I think the consumers are the answer, the potential pet owners. So if we don't sustain the market for them, they will go away. It's hard because it's heartbreaking when you see the puppy in the window. You want to help that particular puppy, but by doing so, you create a market for yet another one to come into that window. And I don't have the answer to that. It's a dilemma. But I think the consumer, really, the potential pet owner, is the solution to the problem. If we end the market for them, the demand for them, eventually they will stop. Certainly, I'm not saying we shouldn't increase the protections and increase the penalties for puppy mills, but I don't think that's the answer. Because again, you know, you have to get a report, you have to find these people, you have to use enormous resources to prosecute them, to investigate them, prosecute them. You have to house the animals. So if you raid a puppy mill and you have 500 dogs, what are you going to do with 500 dogs? So I think and we should do that. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but I think the answer is let's not keep the demand up for those places.
And in defense of pet shops, not all pet shops have puppy mills.
But right,
So saying absolutely, don't get it from a pet stores. What I would say is if you go to a pet store, demand information as to where the puppy came from. If it says Iowa, something suspicious, then I would definitely say no go.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to agree to disagree with you on that. I don't want to paint pet store owners in a bad light. I don't. They're business owners just like the rest of us and all of that, and they can do what they do. It's just my preference to adopt.
Right, it's a personal opinion.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of nice dogs, not from puppy mills, come from pet shops too, but yes. I think adopting the other thing that we are concerned with, Catherine, this issue is some of the puppy mills are disguised as breeders, and that gives a bad name to breeders. And breeders are people who breed a specific breed because they like them, and they sell them to people who like them. Like, it doesn't matter what breed, but sometimes these puppy mills are hidden as breeders, and
right.
So you got to be real careful when you are buying a dog. Other than adopting or fostering or Humane Society, is to where they're coming from. And if you go to that home and they have like 50, 60 dogs, start to question yourself as what kind of operation is it. So don't be critical.
Right.
And don't be afraid to walk.
And the internet is really helpful to the puppy mills because, you know, they can make themselves look really good. You know, they have a home setting on their page, and you know, and then if you order from another state, I mean, you're most likely not gonna be able to fly out there and look at it, and you know,
correct.
So that's where the local breeders come in, or get recommendations from your veterinarian, from your groomer, maybe people that you trust.
Those are good people to go to,
right?
Good people to go to. And I remember, Catherine, too, reading those pages and pages of puppy mills, and as a veterinarian years ago, not so much now, but they're more hidden, I think. But I used to get dogs that were just horrible condition and or had really bad genetic problems. And that's been a real problem.
Well, you remember my poodle, Waylon.
Oh, Waylon, yes.
Waylon was a puppy mill survivor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, it's...
local puppy mill.
Yeah, so it doesn't necessarily have to be Iowa.
Nope, it doesn't.
Yo is back on the phone again. Yes, sir.
This is a very interesting program. On this subject, I thought I'd add my particular experience. I've always had working dogs, and years ago I had bred my Border Collie bitch with an AKC registered dog, so I was going for bloodline. They were papered animals. And then when I had my litter, I had my choice, of course, and then I advertised in Uncle Henry, and I received threatening phone calls from vigilantes accusing me of running a puppy mill and calling me a Nazi and that kind of thing. And I just thought that was a little over the top. I do agree it's important to see where your dog comes from. More recently, I bought a Grand Pyrenees Anatolian Shepherd cross, once again, as a work dog, from the farm. And the farmer looked at me, just his one pair of dogs and one litter. He looked at me and he said, "You're not going to make a pet of this dog, are you?" And I said, "Oh, no, this is a working animal." And she has been an absolutely lovely dog. I did have her spayed for various reasons. And I think it really is important to go and see what kind of dog you're getting and to know what the breed is. Thanks again for putting on this program.
Thanks, y'all. What is disappointing is the vigilante, I'll use Yo's term, kind of ruins the whole idea of the rest of us trying to get rid of the puppy mill. Not Yo, of course. That sounds like someone was just really pissed off. But people taking it in their own hands, and that's like anything legally is not a good idea, right?
Right, absolutely. For a while, within the animal activism movement, there was a plea to call listings in Uncle Henry and say, you know, if you sell your dog somehow to the public without checking or listing or on the internet or in Uncle Henry's or however, you know, please be aware that you don't know where the dog is going and all of that. The plea for activism there was, you know, to be respectful, and certainly was not intended to target anybody or insult anybody or be rude or anything like that. So you're right. That's absolutely inappropriate. But I, you know, and I, sometimes people get out of control, unfortunately.
Yeah, you
know,
and you have people with good intentions like Yo, who is breeding legitimately, yeah, being targeted, and then right, they don't deserve that. And that's so
right.
It
absolutely
goes both ways.
Yeah, it does.
Animal activism has to stay within the law and within civility.
Right. And, you know, remember, animal activists are people too, you know, and with all the problems that come with that, you know, and any other active, I mean, you get people in any movement that are, you know, over the top and take it too far, and, you know, hurt the reputation of those of us who try to be respectful and stay within the law.
So you don't know anything, you haven't come across any new trends or anything with puppy mills or breeding mills, or
I think it's
been kind of quiet now?
Yeah,
it's
the same old thing, you know. It's like, please look at my beautiful website, and it's, you know, pulling at the heartstrings. Look at this dog, you know, and it's the same old thing. So it really just continues. And, of course, you know, with the new administration, they took down all the information.
Yes.
Public information as to enforcement and oversight and complaint. So that's kind of been
makes it harder.
Difficult. Yes, yes.
So I
do know the national groups are still Humane Society, Animal Legal Defense Fund. They're all still working on the issue.
I think it's more, I think it's Catherine maybe pointed out, or Sarah, but it's hidden.
Yes.
It's more hidden. So you're thinking you're getting it from a breeder, and it's really illegitimate.
Yes. I mean, they realized, you know, their marketing problems, and they addressed them. And unfortunately, it makes it harder for the buyer to kind of figure out where's the animal
very
coming
difficult
from.
So the hoarder, someone who's getting back to the hoarding, kind of transition into, you mentioned an older woman getting all these cats.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of elderly people that are shut-ins, fixed incomes.
Homebound.
Homebound. You don't like shut-in.
No, I don't.
Okay. Actually, I don't blame you. So homebound, that's right. I even have homebound on my notes here. You corrected me last year.
I did.
And, you know, the homebound people that have pets or don't have pets or can't have pets, what's going on there in terms of our society?
I think
pets and elderly.
Yeah. Well, generally, I think, you know, our society continues to move towards recognizing how important animals are. And, you know, we have a very elderly state. And so for a lot of people, I do a lot of elder law. And for a lot of people, that's their only sort of social network is their pet, you know. So that's really hard. And then, you know, people sometimes are on fixed income. They can't feed the pet. They can't spay or neuter. They can't provide veterinary care. So it can be really difficult. And they want to. It's not that they don't want to. And, you know, we've all heard the stories of the elderly person who feeds the dog and doesn't get his or her medication at the pharmacy because there isn't enough money to do both.
Right.
The Eastern Area on Aging has a pet food bank, actually, that also covers Hancock County. And so Ryan and I donate sometimes when we're able to. So there's a pet food bank there now.
Just to remind you, this is Pet Sounds 2.0. If you want to call in at 469-0500, this is WERU 89.9 in Orland. And this is Dr. John Hunt, and I have my returning guest, Christina Perkins, a lawyer in Ellsworth. We're talking about all sorts of things. We're just talking about the elderly and the homebound, and there are some local, is that a local food bank thing, or is that state?
It's usually counties. I think almost every county has one now. Eastern Area on Aging is located in Bangor, okay. But they cover Hancock County and they cover Penobscot County. I'm not sure what else they cover, but they do have a food bank there.
So what happens if someone says, well, if you're homebound and you can't afford a pet, you shouldn't have one? This is that would be someone who would, it's just being a devil's advocate.
Right, and that does happen. Again, you know, it's I don't think we should use funding as a criteria. I mean, if you're able to find help to support the pet, if the pet has otherwise a good home, you know, I mean, I can think of plenty of people with means who do not take care of their animals. So I don't think that's the standard. I think that as a community, we want to look at what programs can we provide to help pets stay in the home so they don't end up in the shelter where we have to find a new home for them, but also enable the person to have their support, their social network there. You know, that might be the only being they ever see on a daily basis.
So education, family counseling, what would help?
I think,
because
you know,
it's just not money. Like you say, that there are a lot of rich people who don't take care of the pets at all.
Exactly. Yes, it's
so
not
older,
a matter of money.
An older woman homebound that would be a wonderful pet owner, but they don't have their Social Security check only covers so much.
Exactly. Yes.
So, yeah, we have food banks, but
and,
how about,
you know, Meals on Wheels will also deliver pet food.
Oh, will they?
Yes. At least in some areas. I believe in Hancock County they do. Yes.
See, so there's a lot of little things. So, who would you contact if you were an elderly person yourself or have a relative? Who would you call?
I would call the Eastern Area on Aging if you're in Hancock or Penobscot County.
Okay.
But if you're in another county, there's usually areas on aging. In the Augusta area, I think it's Senior Spectrum or something like that. So
they would have resources to
Yes.
Call.
And they are very, very aware of it. Yes, absolutely.
So pet and the elderly are something very important to these organizations.
Yes,
well,
they do recognize the value and the support that pets provide and how important they are. And they're really family members for most of us, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
But particularly for homebound elders who really, again, you know, may not have any family left. All their friends have died.
Yep.
They can't really drive anymore. They don't go out much. So it's the dog or the cat or both that provides the social support network for them that keeps them healthy and home. Now, the problem, one of the issues that I often encounter is, you know, the elderly person now is no longer able to stay at home. What happens to the pet?
Right.
And we because facilities don't typically allow you to bring them. So
right.
That can be a problem.
And I want to ask about safety and legal stuff in a second, because we do have another caller, Mary. Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you. How are you today?
Fine. Do you have a question for us or a comment?
A question. It's getting to that point in life where I need to make a will out, and I'm wondering, I'm thinking about leaving it to a local organization, and I'm just wondering on Christina's comments on that, and I'll hang. Thank you.
Good. Our last talk last year, we did talk about wills, but this is a specific question. Mary wants to leave part of her estate to an organization, I think is the question.
Yeah, Mary, does that include pets or assets?
Well, it would depend on when that time comes, so possibly both.
Okay. Yeah, there are a number of options. I think at the outset, you want to reach out to whatever local organization you are considering, meet with them, talk to them, see if they're willing to do it, see if they're able to do it. And then very often shelters will have sort of their own form and their own person that does the charitable giving piece, the estate planning piece. So they will have specific questions to ask you and things like that. But really the important piece is to talk to them first to make sure that they're actually willing to do so. And then think about a backup, you know, in case that organization is no longer in existence at the time that you die. And then think about, you know, what kind of pets do you have, where would they best go, you know, as a good, safe environment for them. Are there family members that might be able to step in, that kind of thing.
And it could be,
okay, thank you very much.
And it could be different. You can have the assets go to one place and the pet go to another.
Right. Or you can make a provision where you say, okay, you take my dog and I will give you X amount of dollars to take care of my dog. Or I give you everything I have. And if you don't spend it on the dog, you get to keep it and use it for the other animals. Absolutely. Yes.
So you can stipulate just about anything you want.
Yeah.
As long as you stipulate.
And, you know,
because the judge is going to go by what you wrote. Right.
Or your personal representative, because most of the time probate doesn't go before the judge these days in Maine.
Oh, okay.
So it's really the personal representative. So you want to leave detailed instructions on what to do. And yeah, we can even write trusts now in Maine. We have statutory pet trusts now. So there are lots of options. Absolutely.
Very good. As an addendum to our last discussion. In terms of us, the elderly and the homebound, getting back to that for a second, safety. Of the pet, safety of the elderly, have there been any legal and other questions, any legal things that came up in that realm, the elderly and a pet?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, the first question. We have to worry about safety. My mom was 98. We had to remove the cat because she would either stumble over it or grab it inappropriately. So that's a real issue.
Yes.
And I wonder if you have any comment on that.
You know, that's really, that's a tough area. It's really up to the family members, whoever the powers of attorney or, you know, relatives are that take care of it, to use their best judgment. I don't think you want to get to the point where the law gets involved. I think you want to do so, if possible, do something before then. Certainly, you know, Adult Protective Services is very familiar with that kind of situation, because when they get a call, a complaint, they go out and investigate, and often there are animals there. And then Adult Protective Services, you know, if the person goes to the hospital and then to rehab and then maybe into long-term care, the department is, you know, and there's no family member willing or able to step forward, the department has to make a decision as to what happens to the pet. So sometimes it can be Adult Protective Services that makes that decision.
So that's when the quote-unquote law steps in.
Yes, yes.
But
Department of Health and Human Services, yes.
Okay. But the best route would be for the family to be aware of what's going on, the family members. Even if they're out of state, they should be aware of how the elderly person is.
I can give you an example. I am a personal representative for someone, for someone's estate who died, and she had pets. And she discussed it with me. We have phone numbers, contact information, and the dogs are going to a breed rescue. The cats are going to a friend. And she appointed another person to kind of oversee that. So she has an additional safety layer because she has this friend who is unable to take the animals but is willing to oversee sort of the adoption. And she died unexpectedly. So something like that, you know, have a friend, couple of people in case one is not available that kind of oversee and make phone calls and maybe say, you know, if my client dies and I don't necessarily know about it, but I do know there are pets, you know, have somebody call and say, hey, we've got a pet here, so that we, you know, we all hear the sad stories about the elderly person died in the hospital. Maybe they were pets at home, but no one knew, you know. So, I mean, you can get into having your little ID cards, you know, your alert cards in your wallet. If you get into an accident or hospitalized, and let's say, you know, my pet is home alone, call.
Oh, you can add that to your...
Oh, yeah, 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 absolutely.
I didn't know that.
Yes, absolutely. You can put that in your wallet. You can put that on your fridge. If the EMT crew comes, you know, you can say, hey, you know, my pet is here. If you need to take me to the hospital, call, you know, call this number, and hopefully they will. I would think that they would if they have time, you know, if it's an emergency, sometimes that's hard. But somebody, you know, a neighbor, a friend that can make a quick call and say, you know, even, you know, it might have to be a board. I've had clients who had a boarding facility as backup and have said in their directives, you know, if I get injured, here's where I want the cat to go until I'm either gone or able to take the cat back.
Oh, none of us think about that.
Right, right.
Because even of us, we're not elderly yet, but...
Right.
Contingency plan.
Exactly, and talk to people. I mean, you know, yeah. I can write you the most beautiful advanced healthcare directive and powers of attorney and will, but if you don't talk to the people that are going to be doing the work for you when you can't yourself, it doesn't really help because they're either not aware or they don't know, or, well, I don't know what she meant by that.
Right.
So really having a conversation is really the first critical piece around that.
Good bit of information. Excellent, excellent. Well, we're drawing close, but I want to change. I got about 3 minutes. I want to change topic a little bit. As you know, the news about this young lady coming across a raccoon and how she dispatched the raccoon. But in terms of wild animals coming face to face with wild animal and your pets, you go out in the woods all the time. You're an avid hiker and a biker. And I wonder if you had come face-to-face with a wild animal and your pets.
Yes, I have indeed.
How come I'm not surprised?
Well, you know, when you're out as much as we are. I've encountered bears on my bicycle before, so without pets. But just right here in Orland, the dogs and I ran into a bear. And I decided to sort of take a step back and kind of
was
wait.
Was it a path?
It was a trail up a mountain, and the bear crossed at some distance. The dogs noticed it before I did, obviously. They always do. But it was around the corner, and I didn't see it, but the dogs picked it up. And so when I was on alert because my dogs had, you know, sensed something. So I looked around the corner, and there's the bear. So we backed off, and we walked away. We waited some time, and I thought, enough time, and then continued on the hiking path, and so did the bear. So we saw the bear a second time. I thought, you know, the bear had left. And so what I said is, okay, we're out of here. So safety, you know, over our desire to get to the summit. And then 2 years ago, I had a standoff, sort of, with a moose right here in Orland. And you remember Heike, my little dachshund. She took care of it. The moose, I don't know if the moose was ill, but every time I moved away, the moose would get closer to us. So I didn't really know what to do because there was no way for me to get out of it because every time I moved, so I stopped. And then finally, my little dachshund saw the moose and started barking like a dachshund does. And
the moose
decided it was best to just really run the other direction.
So. Dachshund's the hero.
Yes, she saved the day.
They can sound so ferocious.
Yes.
Well, an hour has gone by. Christina Perkins, a lawyer from Ellsworth, my guest. We had many, many good topics today. Thank you for coming back and spending this hour. This is Pet Sounds 2.0. Dr. John Hunt, your host. And remember, enjoy your pet and don't forget to give them a hug.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Skudik Arts for All, presenting the Eastern Maine Woodturners